anything yet. But now Manu is going to respond to Kardama's kind greeting. And in what he says, we're going to hear about how the Brahmins and the Kshatriyas depend on one another. Kardama is a sage living in the forest. Actually, he doesn't need to get involved with the ruling class. Brahmins can live without the Kshatriyas, actually. But then they have to stay, as I mentioned, they've got to stay aloof. If they want to live in contact with the rest of human society, then they need the support of the Kshatriyas. If they want to serve some sort of social role and not just be hermits, then they have to work together with the Kshatriyas. They don't have the physical strength to protect themselves, or they cannot. Of course, a Brahmin can function as a Kshatriya if he's so empowered. There are special cases. Dronacharya was a Brahmin, but he was as good a warrior as almost anybody else on the Battle of Kurukshetra. Lord Parashuram was a Brahmin, but he killed all the Kshatriyas in the world 21 times. So a Brahmin, theoretically, not just every Brahmin, but theoretically a Brahmin can easily, with his Brahma Tejas, assume the role of a Kshatriya and muster the physical power to defeat everybody else. But normally they don't do that. That really is giving up their higher position, trading their Brahma Tejas for what can be accomplished by a Kshatriya, which is just material. Kardama certainly has no intention of doing that. He has some business with a Kshatriya. He's going to accept the Kshatriya's daughter for his wife, but that's it. He's not even going to get involved in helping Kardama. He has no intention to help Kardama rule the kingdom. He's not going to become a political advisor like some other Brahmins. Anyway, let's read and see what happens here. Text 1, chapter 22. Maitreya Uvacha. Read if you want. Evam Adishkuta Shesha Guna Karnodayo Munim Savida Ivatam Samrad Uparatam Uvacha. Sri Maitreya said, after describing the greatness of the emperors, manifold qualities and activities, the sage became silent, and the emperor, feeling modesty, addressed him as follows. So the real Kshatriya and the real Brahmin, meeting one another, they actually are very respectful. They're very careful in their dealings with one another. Both of them, both Manu, the Kshatriya, Kardama, the Brahmin, they both realize that they're dealing with somebody very important, not someone to be trifled with. And they're both feeling actually quite humble. Kardama is feeling honored to be visited by the king, the emperor. And the emperor will hear how he feels about meeting Kardama in the next few verses. Anyway, the emperor says, it says here the emperor feels very modest, embarrassed. Kardama didn't say very much. He just simply commented that, you, the king, protect the citizens. You embody the protecting energy, power of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And if you didn't travel the earth on your chariot, followed by your mighty army, then human society would become disrupted. And it was a very, very simple presentation, just a few statements. He didn't elaborate very much on the whole science of politics. He just simply, in a few words, delimited what is the proper function of the kshatriya, and what's the glory of the kshatriya, how this great service that he does. Okay, so we can go ahead to verse 2. Text 2. Manurvacha brahma sujad samukato yushman atma paripsaya chandu nayas tapo vidya yoga yuktan alam tatan. Manu replied, to expand himself in Vedic knowledge, where Brahma, the personified Veda, from his face created you, the Brahmanas, who are full of austerity, knowledge, and mystic power, and are averse to sense gratification. So Manu, he's not a fool. He's very well educated in Vedas and in the Dharma Shastras. He understands what's a Brahman. He says the Brahmins were created from the mouth of Lord Brahma. Lord Brahma is simply the representative of the Supreme Lord, his agent for creating this world. In the Purusha Sukta, it's stated Brahmins are created from the mouth of Lord Vishnu. Lord Gavadakshaya Vishnu alone was present at the beginning of creation, the Purusha, the Mahapurusha. And when the demigods first appeared from the glance of Mahavishnu, then appeared within the universe and took up their functions, ruling the different elements in the universal form, the universal form which manifests from Gavadakshaya Vishnu, from his lotus navel. They wanted to do their duty to create the universe, but creation and all other useful activity in this world has to be performed on the basis of sacrifice. So the demigods knew they had to perform a sacrifice. How can they do this? The world hasn't even been put together yet. Yeah. Nowadays in India, it's hard to perform a proper Vedic sacrifice because, for one reason, you can't get pure ghee. Now, at least on the market. If you have your own cow, maybe you can do it. But this is why Indian housewives don't cook in ghee so much. They use oil because if they buy vegetable oil, at least they know what they're getting. But if you try to purchase ghee, you don't know. You never know whether it's cow ghee, buffalo ghee, or whatever. What's in it? So you can't perform sacrifice, but that's not available. The pure ingredients are hard to find. Let us see here at the beginning of creation, when there was nothing available. There wasn't any ghee on the market. There wasn't any market. There wasn't any planets. Yeah. So Vedic sacrifice has so many stipulations. You need 7 different kinds of wood. You need clay utensils. You need so many physical things to perform the sacrifice. So many specific offerings that have to be made. Nothing's available. You know, even the 10 elements haven't been put together yet to make anything. So the demigods were in a quandary. Again, Lord Vishnu personally intervened to help. And he provided his own body in the shape of a universal form to supply the ingredients of sacrifice. So it's described in the Purusha Sutta, specifically, how that in the beginning of creation, the ruling demigods, the creators, performed the first sacrifice from the body, using for the ingredients the body of Gavadakshaya Vishnu. And there it describes that from the mouth of the Purusha came the Brahmins. That's the function of the mouth. Speak and mouth, there's input and output. The output is speaking, the input is eating. So on behalf of the Supreme Lord, the Brahmins speak and they eat. Now how do you feed Lord Vishnu? Okay, if you are a Brahmin, you can worship the Shalagram Shila. And it says, the stipulation is for Brahmin, if he eats anything before doing Shalagram worship, then he goes to hell. What about people who aren't fit to install or to worship the Shalagram? What are they supposed to do? So you can worship, you can feed the Supreme Lord by feeding the Brahmas. You know, Lord Vishnu eats through the mouth of the Brahmas. This is very important. The rest of society who don't have initiation, don't have diksha, don't have upanayanam, and can't directly themselves worship the Supreme Lord in the Shalagram or any other form, they can serve the Brahmins. Just by feeding the Brahmins, they're feeding the Supreme Person. That's one of the functions of the mouth of the Supreme, represented by the mouth of the Brahmin. And then the Brahmin speaks the Vedic knowledge out of his mouth. Vedas are meant originally, the original knowledge which manifests the intelligence of God is meant to be spoken and heard. Prabhupada talks in the purport somewhere in this chapter how one's relationship with the Guru is not with all the senses, it's with the ear. One deals with the Guru using only one's ear, not the other senses. The important interaction with the Guru is to hear from him. So the Vedic knowledge has to be transmitted by the Brahmin speaking and the rest of the people hearing. The Vedas are not meant originally to be written down and studied with the eyes, or put into on a hard drive, or transmitted over internet. This is not the original means of transmission. It's by use of the mouth and the ears. Actually, the injunction is there that it's aparad to study the Vedas out of a book. In the ancient times, before Kali Yuga, the Brahmin students go to the Gurukul and they learn by rote memorization, not by sticking their nose in the book. It was offensive to even write down the Vedas, or certainly to study the Vedas out of a book. Nowadays, people don't have the strong intelligence to memorize anything anymore. So the ancient system is not practical anymore. So it's okay, we study out of books. But the original system is, no, not out of books, using your ears. Pay attention, not just, flip a page and stare at something. A Brahmin is traditionally called Sutta Kanti. Kanta is mouth, rather throat. And sutra are the aphorisms of knowledge, like the Vedanta Sutra. Or beginning student, young student studies grammar, he studies Panini Sutras, 4,000 sutras that contain all the rules of Sanskrit grammar. And sutra kanti means that he's got these sutras, these sound bites of Vedic knowledge, on the tip of his tongue. In his throat means on the tip of the tongue. He can bring up from his well-trained memory any piece of information needed. If you learn by oral reception properly from a young age, then you get that kind of strong memory. All the knowledge is on the tip of your tongue. But if you learn out of books, then you have to consult, open up the dictionary and look up everything. That's not real knowledge. Especially if you just cram the books the night before you take a test, and the day after you take the test, you forget it all. Anyone who studied in an Indian school, this is modern Indian education, just pass the test and forget everything. And someone who's got an MA, PhD in Sanskrit can't speak a word. Because he's passed all his exams and forgotten everything the next day. Real Brahminical education is hearing. So, therefore, very important function of the Brahmins. The Brahmins are the teachers. And besides eating, the output from their mouths is the valuable instructions of the Vedic revelation that they speak. Anyway, this is going to be discussed a little more in the verses. to expand himself in Vedic knowledge, Lord Brahma, the personified Veda, created from his face, created you, the Brahmins. And then he concisely lists the main qualities of proper Brahmins, who are full of austerity, knowledge, and mystic power, and are averse to sense gratification. If someone can develop these four qualities, one, two, three, four, five qualities, four, then he can be called a Brahmin. He's a proper Brahmin. Not that this is easy. These to actually live according to these standards cannot be done superficially. It comes, it used to come by good birth. You know, the first thing that helps you get a good start to becoming austere, learned, full of Brahma Tejas, and to be disinterested in sense gratification. In ancient times, the first great advantage that helps you rise to that standard is to take a good birth in a Brahmin family. So again, going back to the Vedic times, in the Upanishads, we read so many lists of family descent. You know, so-and-so rishi was the son of this rishi, and his grandfather was this rishi, and his great-grandfather was that rishi, going back 20, 30 generations. When you're born in such a family, when everybody was a great Brahmin, learned, austere, full of mystic power, and disinterested in sense gratification, then naturally, having that kind of blood in your veins, that's the first good advantage. And then if you get a proper education, and you get proper spiritual and material guidance, then you can become like that. You know, with a 20, 30 years of training, then you can become a proper Brahmin. Any comments or questions here? If not. Okay, did everybody hear that? Yeah. Is it okay for a Brahmin to speak something he hasn't fully realized? It's not so good. Yeah. Sometimes we have to speak things that we've heard and we simply repeat. Yeah. Many of the things we say, if you're asked to give a Bhagavatam class, we say so many things we have no real personal realization of. Talking about love of God and so many things that we only know by name. So very often we can't avoid talking about things that we don't have much realization about. And we simply repeat, try not to change even the words, because we don't really know what we're talking about. But effective preaching or effective teaching for a Brahmin of anything should be based on personal realization. You know, if you want to be a good preacher, then talk about what you know. Don't talk above your own head. Try to stick to what you've realized. But sometimes you can't. Sometimes we have to. Sometimes we don't have much realization, and we have to just say things, repeating what the previous authorities have said. Yes, Prabhu, please.
These five items, I find the appearance of mystic power is interesting. One of the items called the Brahmin.
Yes.
Do you make reference to someone else?
I'm speculating now, but I don't think it means cheap tricks, you know, to dazzle the audience and, you know, make impress people. No, I think the mystic power is to be able to change people's hearts. Prabhupada said that about himself. You know, my mystic power, two things that he said. One was that he can change Europeans and Americans into Vaishnava Brahmins. That's a mystic feat. It's like trying to wash coal, he said. Another thing he said, I can be in a room with 100 beautiful women and not be disturbed. That's my mystic power. So I think it's the mystic power to just by your words change people's hearts and change reality. By giving your blessings to someone or cursing someone, you're creating a reality. That's like a magic trick. You know, I bless you, you know, that you will attain love of God, that your life will become perfect. Just by those words, he's creating the reality. That's magic. Or similarly, a curse. You know, you're going to be a serpent in your next life. So that's mystic power. The power of the Brahman to create reality just by saying something. That's it. That's the Brahminical mystic power. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
And that's what we see all the time. Brahmans just saying something, and then someone's life is totally changed by them having said a few words. Yes, okay. Tapa Vidya Yoga. Yeah. Prabhupada is translating the word yoga as mystic power. It could be translated otherwise. I would guess that, you know, I know from my familiarity with how Prabhupada writes his purports, he usually doesn't just make up something out off the top of his head. Although the word is just yoga, and you could translate yoga as just power of meditation, you know, or union with God. But probably either Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati or one of the Sanskrit commentators, you know, interpreted it to mean mystic power. Sorry, I didn't take the trouble to look at all these the commentaries, but you know, if we look, we probably find that that's not just Prabhupada making this up. It is said that each of the four sampradayas has their own opulences. And Brahma Sampradaya is knowledge, especially. Sri Sampradaya has the opulence of the riches of the goddess of fortune. So all the Sri Vaishnavas have all the big temples. The Kumara Sampradaya and the Rudra Sampradaya. The Kumara Sampradaya, they have the power mystic powers, and the Rudra Sampradaya has the power of austerity. Or the other way around, I'm sorry. Someone remember which one it is. But, you know, two of the other opulences are austerity and mystic power. And each of the sampradayas owns one of these, Vaishnava sampradayas owns one of these austerity opulences. So the mystic yoga powers are considered a Vaishnava opulence. It must be that the Kumaras are the austere ones, and Lord Shiva has the mystic powers. Brahmins have mystic powers, but if they're proper Brahmins, they don't misuse them. They use them sparingly. And because a Brahmin is not out just to create a cheap reputation for himself, but he's a real Brahmin, his intention is to benefit everybody he comes in contact with, to spiritually elevate everybody. He's only going to use his super worldly powers for spiritual purposes, to enlighten people spiritually. Okay. Lord Brahma created the Brahmanas from his mouth, and the statement here is Atma Paripsaya. The purpose, the intention that Lord Brahma had was to Atma Paripsaya. Now, this word Paripsaya, the translation says one thing, the word for word, the purport says another. To protect himself by expanding. This is interesting. So Lord Brahma, to protect himself, he expanded the Brahmins. Or to protect the Vedic knowledge. The Brahmins are the guardians of Vedic knowledge. And in that way, they're protecting the whole universe by maintaining the Vedic knowledge. If the principles of Dharma are maintained, then the universe is safe. If the principles of Dharma are in disorder, then the universe is in danger of chaos. And by maintaining the Vedic knowledge and the system of Vedic sacrifice, that maintains the principles of Dharma. So it's an essential function of the Brahmins to help maintain the peace and the order, security of the universe, of creation, to teach and live the principles of Dharma according to the Vedas. This is as important and more important than the physical protection that the Kshatriyas give and the demigods. The demigods are managing the universe, but the sages, the original Brahmins, they're doing a more important function of maintaining the principles of religion, without with which, no matter how good the managers, the demigods are, everything will fall into chaos if the principles of Vedic Dharma are not maintained properly. So the Brahmins' function is even more important than the Kshatriyas. Or in other words, the sages are more important than the demigods. So Apaparipaya, first Prabhupada says in the word for word, to protect himself by expanding. And then Prabhupada says in the translation, he translates the same phrase, Apaparipaya, as to expand himself in Vedic knowledge. Prabhupada usually doesn't contradict himself. He doesn't say opposite things in the word for word and in the translation. So they must be equivalent. Lord Brahma protecting himself by expanding means the same thing as his expanding the Vedic knowledge. That's how he protects himself. That's how he protects the universe, by expanding the Vedic knowledge through the Brahmins. The Brahmins are the ones who do that, are his agents in doing that. Okay, so these four qualities of the Brahmins that Manu is seeing in Kardama. Yeah. These two gentlemen are not just flattering one another because they have a business deal to transact. Yeah. Manu has a daughter to get rid of. Kardama needs to find a wife, and therefore they're polite to one another. No. They are actually very appreciative of one another because they recognize the real qualities of Brahman and Kshatriya in one another. Manu has been well educated in Vedic science. He knows what a Brahman is, and he sees, oh yes, you've got these qualities. I can see, I've only met you for a few minutes, but I can see. You've spoken a few words to me, not much, but that's enough, I can see. That you're full of austerity, knowledge, mystic power, and you are averse to sense gratification. It's obvious. You couldn't speak like this if you didn't have those qualities. So of course, these qualities are necessary qualifications of a learned Brahman. Without austerity, which means the word is tapas, right? Tapas is the Sanskrit word here. Very interesting word. The original meaning is the heat of fire. Tap means to burn in Sanskrit, or to burn in the sense, not the sense of feel pain, but the fire itself is burning. The fire is burning. It's creating, it's radiating energy. It's what is, you know, looking at from the dry scientific point of view, what is fire? It's a very fast, intense chemical reaction of oxidation. A very intense chemical reaction. Burning. Now, if the same thing could happen, if it happened much slower, it wouldn't be considered burning. But when you have a fast, you know, conversion of wood to carbon, and then just, you know, oxygen release, and whatever happens when there's fire, when it happens fast and intensely, then you see a fire. So the idea of tapas is intense concentration and effort. That is the spiritual meaning of tapas. Literal meaning is the heat and burning intensity of fire. Tap, to burn. The spiritual idea behind that is the concept of intense concentration and intense effort. It's interesting, it's stated, it's, I think it's the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, it describes how the Supreme Personality of Godhead created this world by tapas. Sotapyata. He, the Supreme Lord, he was the first one to perform austerity. But why does God have to perform austerity? He doesn't have to deprive himself of anything. Take any vows or fast or stand on his head. So it's not tapas in that sense of deprivation or voluntary pain. The Supreme Lord never feels any pain. But he created this world by intense concentration of effort. Now, creation is always an intense effort. When a mother gives birth to a child, it's a very intense effort. For the child to come out of the mother's body is a great effort for the child and the mother. So when the Lord, he's the original mother and father, when he creates the universe, he's exerting himself with great intensity for our benefit. That's tapas. When the sages prepare themselves for doing their functions, whether it's populating the universe or disseminating Vedic knowledge, they perform austerities for many thousands of years. That's also tapas. The purpose of it is to gather their energies, to focus themselves with great intensity. So that's the power of Brahmins. Kshatriyas, they build up their muscles and their physical strength and their political strength, and then they squander it all in battles. They have a one-day battle and they use up all their energy. The Brahmins, they focus their energy. They don't squander it. They use it very sparingly. Brahma teaches. Yes.
Some instruction for Shetra is go out and try to conquer the world. And if you can't do it, then I've pressed the road of monasteries and
So Kshatriyas also are advised to perform austerity. They build up their batteries also, but they discharge their batteries in a different way than the Brahmins do. It's tapas for the purpose of conquest, which is their duty. It's the duty of the Kshatriyas to conquer the world and then rule it. So they prefer, also tapas is required for that. Yes? Tejas, yeah. That's the Tejas and Tapas are very similar words. Tejas is power or radiant light, radiant heat is the literal meaning of Tejas. The element fire is sometimes called Tejas. So Tejas can be just translated as fire. It's the power of the Brahmins, the intelligent power. Now the power by which, just by saying a few words, they can change reality. They can condemn someone to hell or to curse them. Or bless him with love of God just by saying one or two words. That's Brahma Tejas. That power that's even much stronger than the political or economic power that others have.
Yes, ma'am.
What you're saying is the Lord has just said to create the
Supreme Master. That's what it says, yeah. To create. Yes, or Gaudadakshai Vishnu, Besidam, Mahavishnu and Gaudadakshai Vishnu, at the beginning of creation. This is a description of the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad and Chandogya Upanishad also. He concentrated his attention very carefully. Of course, there's no pain involved with the Supreme Lord. It's just a pastime, another sport for him. Sometimes Krishna likes to be a rishi. He likes to perform that pastime also. So sometimes he takes birth as a sage and enjoys performing austerities. This is like Ramanadev, Brahmin boy. And he, must have gotten a gurukul education and, carried firewood and done austerities. The Supreme Lord takes a role like that because he enjoys, I want to also be a rishi and do austerities. It's his pleasure. Or take birth as Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. He wants to experience what it's like to be an austere Brahmin. Okay, posterity, knowledge. Of course, everybody can have some knowledge. Vaishyas know how to do arithmetic, you know, how to take care of cows and farm and do business. Kshatriyas know a lot of things. Even the Shudras know they have their practical skills if they have an occupation. But the knowledge of the Brahmins is knowledge of Dharma, knowledge of the Vedas. That is their special privilege. Kshatriyas also study the Vedas, but they don't become teachers of the Vedas, normally. That's the prerogative of the Brahmins. So, the knowledge belongs to the Brahmins. They share it with everybody, but it's their property, the Vedic knowledge. And you can see who has assimilated this teaching of the Vedas by a person's behavior, Sadachar. Someone with the eyes of Manu was also very cultured. You can see right away, by being with somebody for a few minutes and hearing a few words out of his mouth, you can recognize right away this person has such proper behavior, and he has such a proper attitude toward others. He must be full of Vedic knowledge. No other way that someone could act like this. Can't be imitated, or at least an imitation could be quickly spotted by someone as well educated as Manu. And the mystic power we already mentioned. And then the last quality is a Brahmin has to be averse to sense gratification. He can have all these other good qualities. He could have the power to perform yogic discipline for many years. He can be full of, know all the mantras in the Vedas backwards and forwards and all the explanations of them. And he can have mystic powers coming out of his ears. But if he's attracted to sense gratification, that spoils everything. It can be arranged to drag him down very easily. Indra, who's very envious of someone who might take his position, very often sends the apsaras or somebody else to make these would-be sages fall down. So if there's interest in sense gratification, then it's not very easy to maintain a steady position on the Brahminical platform. A Brahmin has to live a very simple life, not too much sense enjoyment, not too much opulence. It's very dangerous for a Brahmin to accept more than he needs. It's said he shouldn't even collect more than he can use in a single day. If that's first class Brahmin. A Brahmin, minimum is he can't collect more than he can use in 3 years. I think his mother says that. Sometimes Brahmins, have families and they feel the need to, protect their families. It's okay. Maximum is you can store grains for 3 years. Any more than that, you're a sense gratifier. It can be imagined, maybe you have a big family, and maybe in your country, the climate is unsteady and there can be famines. Okay, you can store grains for 3 years, no more than that. Better than that is you can keep it down to 1 year or 1 month. But a first-class Brahmin doesn't store more than anything. He just keeps what he can use the same day. And if because everybody's giving him charity, if he has more than he can use in a day, he has to give it away immediately. If he wants to be considered a first class Brahmin. Yeah. You don't keep overnight, but you can't eat that day. So in this one verse. Yes, sir. Yes. Best Brahmin, yes. He's inspiring. A Brahmin inspires others to come to a similar standard. Yeah. If he's got Brahma Tejas, if he's got some potency, then other people will also be elevated by his association to also assume these qualities of austerity, knowledge, mystic power, and aversion to sense gratification. So, if a really good Brahmin, if he's got a good family, they'll also be willing to live an austere life, a simple life. You got the example of, very good example of Srivas Thakur. Lord Chaitanya glorified him. He said, everybody in your family also has love of God, even your servants. Usually in India, servants are Shudras, and usually can't trust them in a room by themselves, they'll steal everything. Prabhupada said, if a servant doesn't steal from me, he's not very smart. But Srivas Thakur's family, even the servants, the menial servants in the household, they were all pure Vaishnavas, Mahabhagavats. And once Nimai Pandit was joking with Srivas, what are you going to do? I don't see you working. How are you going to maintain your family? You never do any work. You've got a big household. So how are you keeping your family secure? You're not collecting any money. You're not doing anything. And Srivas Thakur clapped his hands 3 times. And Dushyant said, what is that? He said, this is my formula. This is how I take care of my family. If we don't get any food for 3 days, then I'll jump in the Ganga and drown myself. In other words, he's completely depending on Krishna's mercy. He just refuses to come down to the material platform. He's confident that Krishna is going to take care of his family, even though he's got a huge household. He doesn't, nobody, even Lord Chaitanya is wondering how you're going to feed them all. But that's the ideal Brahman. That shouldn't be imitated by those who don't have that spiritual qualification. Yes, yes. Therefore, other devotees of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, they went out and got jobs, but they didn't want to burden Krishna. It's a proper attitude for Vaishnava Grihastha that he should take the trouble to make a proper arrangement to maintain his family rather than dump it on Krishna's head. Even Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, he never got married. He never had any thought of that. But when he finished his university education, he got a bachelor's degree from the University of Calcutta. And what did he do? Okay, he's a Naishiki Brahmachari, never intends to get married. He went out and got a job. Because he didn't want to be like these useless sadhus and just sit around and do nothing. He's still a Brahmachari, he hadn't taken sannyas. So he went and got employment with the Maharaja of Tripura. He became a librarian, worked for him for a few years. Just to set an example, you have to take care of yourself, not just expect Krishna to do everything. And not sit around and be idle. But anyway, the principle here is to be averse to sense gratification. We work hard, but working hard not to collect something for our own security and enjoyment, but we work to fulfill our responsibilities in Krishna's service. Everybody works hard. Whether they're collecting money or just preaching or doing worship, every serious Vaishnava is doing this tapas, this intense concentration of working hard for Krishna. So you can see these two gentlemen, why they're appreciating each other. They're both working very hard for the same general common purpose, to further the welfare of human society. The king, his way, and the Brahmin, his way, but it works together very closely. Interknit, they both need each other. We can move on to verse 3 then. I wanted to go a little slow today, where this section here is practically the center point of the whole. Now, here's the actual encounter between the two great personalities. And they don't say much, so we're focusing on every word practically. Every little word has deep significance here. One quote. Here, Manu is describing the glorious qualities of the Brahmins and how this is very essential, or he will be saying, how the Brahmins having these qualities is essential for the maintenance of human society. In the Taittiriya Brahmana, which is, Taittiriya Samhita is the black Yajurveda. The Yajurveda that has the mantras and the explanations of the mantras mixed up together, not in separate books. And there is a separate book called the Taittiriya Brahmana anyway, with additional explanations. It's the further commentary on the meaning of the mantras of the Taittiriya Samhita. And in that Taittiriya Brahmana, there's a short statement, Brahmano vai prajanam upadrashta. The Brahmana is the supervisor of all the people. Yeah, like a father. He has to look after the welfare of everybody, including the king and all the citizens. It's a big responsibility. But he's competent to do it. Just like a father, nature just gives a father the intelligence how to be a father. You usually don't go to school how to be a father. You don't take courses on it. The intelligence is given to you. So similarly, a Brahmin just knows by his brahminical quality, he knows how to take care of everybody. Anyway, can we look at verse 3?
Tatra naya srijat chasman duh sahasrat sahasratat vidayam tasdihi brahma kshetram andam prachakshate.
Okay, so the previous verse talking about Brahma creating the Brahmins from his mouth. But now he's going back to explaining it, how this creation actually originally came from this thousand-headed Supreme Personality of Godhead, Garbhadakshaya Vishnu. So translation, for the protection of the Brahmanas, the thousand-headed, thousand-legged Supreme Being created us, the Kshatriyas, from his thousand arms. Hence the Brahmins are said to be his heart, and the Kshatriyas his arms. Brahmins are sometimes described as coming from the mouth of the Supreme, and sometimes they're described as his heart, or the head of society. In any case, the Brahmins are the essential part. They're the life center, and especially the source of intelligence, of direction. And the Kshatriyas are the arms manifest the physical strength, the protecting strength. So, the Kshatriyas are very powerful. God gives them, they embody the protecting strength of the Lord. An effective Kshatriya is invincible. At least within his own domain, no one can even approach him. Durdarsha, unapproachable. Rather speak of defeating him, most people can't even come near him. He's so powerful. But, because he's functioning in the mode of passion, his intelligence can become clouded. Especially since he's got his domain. That is, if he's not God, his domain is limited. And there's some other ruler in the next domain. And surrounding him, there are potential enemies. So the Kshatriyas get into conflicts with one another. The mode of passion turns into warfare and descends into the mode of ignorance. So the intelligence of the Kshatriyas, if left untempered, undirected by higher intelligence can get in trouble, can become misguided. Therefore, the Brahmins have to guide the intelligence of the Kshatriyas. The Brahmins need the Kshatriyas because they can't, they're totally vulnerable. They've forfeited, or they've passed up the opportunity to protect themselves. They're depending completely on Krishna's mercy. That's fine if you're living out in the jungle, just you and Krishna. But if you're in the city or in the human society, there are so many people who can abuse you or just neglect you. You know, out in the, in your ashram in the Himalayas or in the jungle, there's Mother Nature is providing everything. You just pick the fruits off the trees and the roots in the ground. But in a big city, how are you going to live unless people are willing to give you charity? So the king has, so the Brahmins, when they enter human society, they need the physical protection of the Kshatriyas. They can't survive, or they can't function in any useful way without the protection of the Kshatriyas. They can manage on their own, but if they're going to be of any use in the ordinary social order, they have to be supported by the Kshatriyas. They can survive on their own, but they can't function practically without the help of the Kshatriyas. But the Brahmins come first. You can live without arms. Not convenient. If someone chops off your arms, your life is going to be somewhat limited. You'll have to find some other way to operate your computer. You won't have any hands. But you can survive. But if someone chops your head off, you're dead. Or carves out your heart, you're dead. So therefore the Brahmins come first. They're the most essential. And Prabhupada quotes the prayer, Namo Brahmanya Devaya Svo Brahmanya Hitaya Cha Jagadhitaya Krishnaya Govindaya Namo Namaha. Obeisances to Govinda. So just looking at what the word means, Govinda, possessor of Go, that means that he is Brahmanya Devaya. Meaning of Govinda is that he is the protector of the Brahmins and the cows. First of all, the Brahmins and the cows. First, Krishna protects everybody, Jagadhitaya. He's made protector of the whole world. He's working for the benefit, Hita, of the whole world. But first, the Brahmins and the cows. That doesn't mean, Brahmins and cows, I'm taking care of everyone else and go to hell. No. By protecting, first of all, the Brahmins and the cows, that's how the best way to protect everybody else. If the Brahmins are maintained, they're peaceful, they can sit down and do their brahminical functions, then human society gets proper guidance. Then the Kshatriyas can be strong and effective, and everybody else will be peaceful. If the cows are maintained, then religious principles will be fortified. Then Krishna is pleased. Then the mode of goodness is promoted, if the cows are protected. And there'll be abundant milk products, healthy food. So these two classes, the cows and the Brahmins and the cows, have to be protected first in order to protect everybody. The priority is, this is not, we shouldn't be ashamed, we shouldn't be afraid to promote this Varnashram concept. We shouldn't think that, this is the modern world, nobody's going to buy it. It's just politically incorrect to talk about or to even come out and say that ISKCON is in favor of Varnashram. But that's our business. Because this is how to benefit everyone. It's not that we're going to, have a privileged class, the Brahmins and the cows, and everybody else gets exploited and oppressed. It's just the opposite. By giving priority to the Brahmins and the cows, then everybody is benefited. That's the meaning of this mantra. And Manu realizes that. He's not at all shy to bow down to Kautama Muni, this young man who he never met before, who was sitting in this ashram covered with ashes, dressed in rags, doesn't own a have a penny in his pocket. He's ready to bow down, put his head at his feet, and give him his daughter. Any comments or questions? Okay, let's look at verse 4. Yes, please. Yes.
The cows and the basic natural resource.
Yes.
Provide some.
Yes.
For sacrifice and the cows and the
yes.
The bowls and plowing. The Brahmins are giving the knowledge of the training everyone to do their obligations so they can produce the necessities of the land.
Yes.
To make on the bowls and to protect the resources.
Yeah, but that can only be realized if you're living a natural lifestyle. You know, if you're living artificially, then it's hard to see. You can, you know, understand it theoretically, but if you're living on the land and you have a cow, you can see it. How it's just it's a natural ecology. Yes. Yeah. That we know enough of demoniac culture. We just keep the cows to turn into hamburgers. Okay. This leads right into the text 4. Ato yanyonyamatmanam brahma kshatram chadapshataha rakshati smadhyayo devaha sayat sarasaratpataha. That is why the Brahmins and the Kshatriyas protect each other as well as themselves, and the Lord himself, who is both the cause and effect and is yet immutable, protects them through each other. Rakshataha. That's why the Brahmins and the Kshatriyas protect each other as well as themselves, and the Lord himself, who is both the cause and effect and is yet immutable, protects them through each other. Rakshataha. So the word rakshataha, or protects, the two of them protect one another. This is the key idea here. And then he says again, rakshati, in the third line. You think of Kshatriyas as protectors. Brahmins, we were discussing, Brahmins are protecting by maintaining religious principles. They're actually a stronger force. They're a much more subtle and potent force than the physical strength of the Kshatriyas. It, as the Prabhupada discusses in the purport, how this whole system that begins with the cooperation, mutual working together of the Brahmins and Kshatriyas, is a system for cooperation so that everybody can be uplifted to the highest platform of spiritual realization. We were attracted to ISKCON for this reason, more or less, I think. We may have had, in the beginning, other attractions. I was attracted by someone else's. But what really attracts us to give our life to this movement is that it's obviously a movement for universal spiritual upliftment. For ourselves, and then we go out and try to deliver the world. That's our purpose. That's our transcendental spiritual society. But the whole Vaishnava system is for that purpose, just in a broader way. You know, it expands itself and deals with more with the material energy, deals more with the material condition situation of the living entities, and has to work out ways. The vibrational system contains means for human beings of all different kinds to be able to work together, live cooperatively and peacefully, progressively. But the ultimate purpose is the same as a society of a purely spiritual society of renunciance. And it is, that everybody become fully Krishna conscious. Especially the Daivi Varnashram system. Modern world is degenerated because there's the sages are gone. And there's nobody with pure spiritual intentions guiding the Varnashram system. So it becomes Rakshasa Varnashram, or the modern caste system. It's just the different classes, especially the Brahmins, insisting on their privileges, even though they haven't done anything to deserve it. You know, they want Brahma Bhojana, they want bhakshis, but they can't perform any brahminical service. They've done nothing to deserve the 10 rupees they're demanding. And you know, the rulers, the government is trying to maintain their privileges, and every person in every class in society, the women, the different, you know, the tribals, and everybody's trying to push their own separate interests in conflict with everybody else. So there's class struggle and just the, you know, and conflict instead of cooperation. That's the modern social system, or a modern lack of a system. But the what makes Varnashram, or especially the Daivi Varnashram, different is the basic foundation of cooperation, of working together peacefully, willingly accepting different roles, voluntarily. Daivi Varnashram is different in that it's guided by pure devotees. When whoever organizes the system, the Brahmins, who are the masterminds, when they have love of God, then they can, because they have it, they can give it to others. And it filters down through the system. Anybody who participates in the system is also going to be gradually elevated to that. Because the leaders, the spiritual leaders, have the highest thing, others can also get it. If the so-called spiritual leaders don't have the spiritual goods, then how can they give it to anybody else? So Daivi Varnashram is organized and led by pure devotees. That's what makes it different. It gives it its spiritual potency. It's like Prabhupada said, I will go to Gita Nagari and I'll show you how to live in the land. Now, the direction is coming from the pure devotee, therefore the potency is there to actually elevate the participants up to the level of pure Krishna consciousness. Even though it's not the same, it's not sadhana bhakti. Sadhana bhakti is not raghunuga bhakti. They're two different things. Someone who is practicing the rules and regulations can't claim that he has love of God, or if he does, he's wrong. You know, he's bewildered or he's a hypocrite. If a person is simply going through the motions of practicing, you know, his vows, claims that he has love of God when he doesn't, that's not correct. Because sadhana bhakti is not raghunuga bhakti. Raghunuga bhakti means to be fully absorbed in love of God and think of Krishna constantly, his pastimes, his personal qualities. Are we doing that? Are we meditating only on Krishna 24 hours a day and no attention at all to the material energy? Yes, okay, we're not. We have to be honest. We're not on that level. We're on this level. We're practicing sadhana bhakti, trying to. Similarly, the practice of the Varnashram rules and regulations is on a different level, on a lower level still. It's the third rank. But it's part of the same overall system. It's still for the same end. On a lower level, on a broader level, the accepting roles within the Varnashram system and following those rules and regulations that belong to each different role means, from a material level, admitting, okay, I'm conditioned. I can't even come to the level of sadhaka. still gradual elevation is provided, facility for gradual elevation. Just like in previous ages, nowadays, you know, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu was told everybody in the universe, every man, woman, and child should chant Hare Krishna. In previous ages, that, in effect, initiation of everybody, in, you know, everybody in the universe is already initiated, has the privilege to chant Hare Krishna. Lord Chaitanya has initiated everybody. Yeah, so the Hare Nam Diksha is really just a formality. You can, anybody can chant the mantra without initiation. We go out, you know, to Times Square and tell everybody to chant along with us. We don't say, hey, you're drunk, you can't chant this mantra. No, you have to get Diksha first. We don't tell people that. But other mantras you do. Sampradaya Vihina Ye Mantraste Nishpalamata. If you don't receive the mantra through a pampara, by initiation, it's useless. We don't say that about Krishna's names, about the Maha Mantra. Because Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu has already given Diksha. He's ordered every man, woman, and child in the universe to chant. But in previous ages, that wasn't there. That universal initiation wasn't there. And therefore, this Hare Krishna Maha Mantra was not available to everybody. In fact, it was hardly available to anybody. There's 10 offenses. If you commit these offenses, the effects can be worse than not chanting at all. If you chant with offenses, you can undo all the good effects of your chanting and go to hell also. So therefore, normally, this Krishna's name, this Hare Krishna Maha Mantra, is only meant to be chanted by those who are free from offenses. Only by very advanced yogis should this mantra be chanted. It's so secret, it's hardly mentioned at all anywhere in the Vedas. You know, where are you going to find the Hare Krishna Maha Mantra? Kali Samtara Upanishad, it's spelled backwards. You know, it's given second half first. And you probably won't find it anywhere else in all the Vedic literature. Because if it's not Kali Yuga, it shouldn't be made public. Most people are not fit to chant it. Therefore, what are people supposed to do for spiritual advancement? Other processes that are meant for gradual elevation. Kriteya Jayato Vishnu. In Kriti Yuga, Sati Yuga, people meditated for 100,000 years in order to attain Krishna consciousness. And Tretayam Yajatomakai. In Treta Yuga, they performed elaborate Vedic sacrifices. Dwapare Parichayam. In Dwapa Yuga, they worship the deity by strict elaborate means. Gradual processes. Okay. So the karmakanda system of varnashram and of sacrifice, this is meant for gradual elevation. Chaturvanya Maya Shrishtam. Krishna says in the Gita, this system, this social system of Varnashrama was created by me. It's not a human concoction. It's not artificial. It doesn't have any beginning in time. And that's reiterated here. Sadasat Atmakaha. The Lord Himself, Rakshati Sma Avyayo Devaha, the infallible personality of Godhead, has actually made this arrangement. It's actually He who, through the Brahmins and Kshatriyas working together, is actually the Supreme Lord who's making that arrangement to protect human society. Sadasad Atmaka, He's the source of everything spiritual and material. So, the spiritual world, where everybody is spontaneously doing the right thing, impelled by love. Raja Bhumi, although you know, we don't see it with our material eyes, we think that Vrindavan's become a wilderness or a place for cheaters and hypocrites. But if we have spiritual eyes, we see that the eternal Vrajvasis are the most cultured people. Nanda Maharaj, Mother Yashoda, all the Brijvasis. They behave so properly with one another. They just know. Not because they've studied the Dharma Shastras or went to school, the etiquette school. They know spontaneously because they're impelled by pure love for Krishna how to deal with one another in a proper way. The women, the men, the children, the Brahmins, the Vaishyas, they all know, understand their individual duties spontaneously. When there's love of God, you don't need to be given any rules and regulations. You don't need to be trained. And when there isn't love of God, and when one doesn't have a taste for hearing and chanting about Krishna, when one's on the third level of material consciousness, then he has to be given rules and regulations, and he has to be given some education. He has to be told how to behave. Nobody has to tell Nanda Maharaj how to be a charitable ruler, how to give charity, how to be respectful to the Brahmins. He knows automatically. But an ordinary king has to be told. He has to study in his gurukul, the duties of a king, and how to give charity, how to protect the citizens. He has to be educated. Okay, I'm sorry, if you had a point.
It's not suggested that, at least in the way it's presented to devotees, that Varnashram is not, like if we think of the temple, like, so it's not an economic solution. Okay, the devotees have maintenance, but that's not what it's about. And the Varnashram is not about a way to make a living.
Yes.
There's a spiritual process to elevate your consciousness.
Yeah, it's not a welfare system.
Yeah, it's not a way to necessarily disorganize society, although it does that.
Yes.
It does provide for maintenance, it does provide for economic solutions, but it's really a process of spiritual process for elevation of consciousness.
Yes.
I think you're stressing that.
Yeah, it's not a cheap solution for our economic problems. There's no cheap way out of the difficulties of material life. But if we depend on the Supreme Lord, then we're taken care of. And so he's so kind, he's giving us three ways to do that. If we can simply think of him 24 hours a day, then no problem. We don't have to worry about anything else. If we can't do that, okay, practice sadhana bhakti. And then the third alternative is work for me and accept the authority of those who are practicing properly. Okay, any other comments? Okay. No? Okay. Here's a few more quotations. On the two points, that Kshatriyas are especially meant to protect the Brahmins, and the Brahmins protect the Kshatriyas. They're protecting one another. And that way, they're maintaining the whole human society. They're protecting everybody else. So there's any number of statements scattered throughout the Vedic literature reiterating this over and over again. Again, we were reading from the Taittiriya Brahmana, going back to the original mantras of the Taittiriya Samhita. There's this statement. Tasmad Brahma Yavan Atyanyam Brahmanam Tasmad Rajanyo Brahmanavan Atyanyam Rajanyam. A Brahmana who is supported by a Raja. Rajanya means king. A Brahmana who is supported by a Rajanya is superior to another Brahmana. Hence, a Rajanya, a king, supported by a Brahmana is superior to another Rajanya. If a Brahman has Kshatriya support, then he can be a better Brahman. Meaning that he can do something practical. Brahmins can survive on their own. And they can go back to Godhead. But if they want to do something for human society, Brahman who becomes advanced and is feeling compassion is not satisfied with his own salvation. He's not satisfied to sit in a cave and go back to Godhead by himself. He wants to come down to the world, back to the city, and save everybody else. And he can't do that without the help of the Kshatriyas. He can't do anything practical. So therefore a Brahman who gets the Kshatriya support is better than a Brahman without that. And certainly a Kshatriya who's got the strong support of the Brahmins is much superior to a Kshatriya who's lacking that. Okay. Then the Aitireya Brahmana, the original commentary on the Rig Veda, states, this is the Brahmana talking to the Kshatriya, this statement. Dyauraham Pitivi Tvam Samaham Rik Tvam Taveha Samvahavahai Puran Yasman Mahavayat Tanurasi Tanvam Ne Ahi. Brahman says to the Kshatriya, I am the sky, you are the earth. I am the Samaveda, you are the Rigveda. May the two of us together sustain the settlements. Let's say, this is an old translation. Settlements means the general population. Or is Vish. Or everybody else. The lower classes. So may the two of us, the Brahman and Kshatriya, maintain everybody else together. You are like my body, Brahman is telling the Kshatriya. Therefore, please protect my body from the greatest dangers. And then an explanation of this statement. Just like the heaven and the earth work together in consort for the smooth working of the cosmic process. What does that mean? On the earth are the human beings who are performing sacrifice. The demigods are enjoying the offerings. That's their food. So demigods are controlling and maintaining the universe, but the human beings, their function in performing sacrifice is also essential. The human beings, the Brahmins especially, but everybody who participates in the performance of sacrifice, they're helping to support the universe by their work of performing sacrifice. And then the demigods do their part. And the Samaveda hymns, the Samaveda chants, join hands for the completion of the sacrifice. If you want to perform a Soma sacrifice, many of the hymns are based on the Rig Veda. The Samaveda hymns use the words of the Rig Veda, and they just set them to special musical, put them into musical compositions in a very complex way. But it's not just entertainment. You cannot perform a Soma sacrifice without the Samaveda prayers. If you can't find competent Brahmins who chant the Samaveda, you can't perform a Soma sacrifice. That's why it's very difficult nowadays to perform a Soma sacrifice, especially the more complicated ones. The simplest Soma sacrifice you can perform in one day. That's just a basic, minimal sacrifice. But a good Soma sacrifice, the next step up is the 3-day sacrifice. Or if you want to get some real benefit, do an 11-day sacrifice. And it goes up the scale. The 7th degree is 1,000-year sacrifice. Sahasra Samamasata. The sages at Naimisharanya at the beginning of Kali Yuga, they sat down to perform sutra. Sutra means soma sacrifice. Specifically means sutra. It's a soma sacrifice. Sahasra Samam, the best kind, 1,000-year sacrifice. They couldn't do it. As far as we know, they never completed that sacrifice. They're complaining to Sutta Goswami, we're trying to do these rituals, we're just getting smoke in our faces. We're feeling frustrated. They probably never completed that sacrifice. But they were trying. Kali Yuga is coming on, we'll do the best thing we know how to do. We know we're rishis, we know how to do sacrifices. We'll sit down for 1,000 years and do the most potent soma sacrifice, and maybe that will help counteract Kali Yuga. Because they ended up putting that aside to hear Bhagavatam instead. But this is Kali Yuga. Nobody's going to perform a 1,000-year sacrifice anymore. 1975, in Kerala, Nambudiri Brahmins successfully performed 11-day sacrifice. And it was a great endeavor. They managed to find a few Samaveda priests, 85-year-old Brahmins. They're not around anymore. So this may be the last time anybody's performed the Atiratra Agnichayana sacrifice, 11-day sacrifice. For the rest of Kali Yuga, nobody will probably be able to perform it again. So therefore, to perform the more elaborate Vedic sacrifices, you need both the Rig Veda and the Samaveda. So just like the Rig and Samaveda have to work together to perform the Soma sacrifice, similarly the Brahmins and Kshatriyas need one another. That's the metaphor. Okay. So we, the Brahmins and Kshatriyas, work in unison for the smooth functioning of the civic machinery. And then two last statements. Okay, that's so much for the original Vedas. Now we move up to the more recent Dharma Shastras, Manu Samhita. From the 10th chapter of Manu Samhita, Sarvesham Brahmano Vidyad Vityupayam Yatavidi Prabhuyad Itarevyascha Swayam Chaiva Tatabhavit. Duty of a Brahman. A Brahman, this is how he gives protection. Kshatriya gives protection by maintaining an army, defending the good citizens and subduing the bad citizens. Brahman gives protection in the following way. A Brahman should properly understand everyone else's means of earning a livelihood. According to the injunctions of scripture, he should explain these teachings to others and himself also act according to them. That's the basic duty of a Brahman in human society. That's how he benefits everybody else. And that's a little bit elaborated in another Dharma Shastra, the Vashishta Dharma Sutra, written by Vashishta Muni. The Brahman was to, I don't have the Sanskrit, but the translation is, the Brahman was to expound the duties of all the other classes, to indicate to them proper conduct and their means of livelihood, and they, the citizens, were to abide by his directions, the Brahman's directions, and the king was to rule in accordance with such directions. Basic relationship. The Brahman and Kshatriyas, and then the rest of society following their guidance. Okay. Any other last comments? Yes, please.
I still don't understand about Prabhupada's Dharma, simply that although the suttas be qualified and conscious to go back to that, but because we understand that one has to be situated in sense of knowledge.
Yes. A Shudra cannot study the Vedas, okay? So he can't, by reading the Vedic mantras and studying the commentaries on them, he can't get that knowledge. But he can get the knowledge other ways, by serving those who are spiritually elevated, the Vaishnavas and the Brahmins, even a Shudra, even women, even persons lower than Shudras, can get transcendental knowledge and go back to Godhead. Yepi shuk papa yonaraha tepi yanti paramgatim. Even persons of the lowest birth, which means they're unqualified to get an ordinary Vedic education, they can be enlightened just by serving others. Anye tveva majananto shutvan yebhyo upasate. Persons who don't have any proper education, if they hear from those who are learned, hearing from others, they can also engage in worshipping the Supreme Lord. Yasmin vigyate sarvam eva vigyatam bhavati. And if you know God, if you know the Supreme Person, then you know everything. So Shudras can go back to Godhead, they can gain tattva again. They can understand their spiritual position, understand that they're Krishna's servants, and that's all that anybody needs to know. All the other technical knowledge is just to serve that purpose, to come to the realization that we're Krishna's eternal servants. A shudra can realize that. A woman can realize that. A child can realize that. That's perfect knowledge. That's sattva gyan.
Yes.
That's right. Without being the mode of goodness? You can't worship the Supreme Lord without being in the mode of goodness. Yes. So what's actually required, ultimately, is initiation into the worship of Vishnu. You need Vaishnava initiation. But Prabhupada has shown us that Shudras and those who are worse than Shudras can be very quickly made qualified for Vaishnava initiation and be given that initiation. We see, we have an Erskine society. We pick people off the street who are much worse than Shudras, and in a few weeks, in a few months, we make them ready for Vaishnava initiation by the association of pure devotees. That's possible. That's what's really required. But the Varnashram system facilitates that on a broader basis. Yes? Yes. Externally, yes. 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 And other great devotees like Jadu Thakur, who accepted externally the role of the sutra. He was, you know, he wanted the association of Vaishnavas, but he was not fit to enter the house of a gentleman, Shudra. So he didn't barge into the house of the Vaishnavas. He'd roam around their backyards and pick up their garbage, you know, eat their remnants. And by eating the remnants of all the Vaishnavas, you know, surreptitiously sneaking around in their backyards, he was full of love of God. He was, you know, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu glorified him for his great qualities. So externally, someone could be living as a Shudra. The more external appearances, and if anybody would materialize, this person is just a Shudra. But he's attained love of God by the association of pure Vaishnavas. So Varnashram system, the secret purpose of the Varnashram system is to allow people to get the association of Vaishnavas. Manu himself, after reading these few chapters of the third canto, will understand that Manu himself is a great Vaishnava. Even though he wrote a book that doesn't say a word about Krishna's devotional service, the Manu Samhita doesn't say much about devotional service. It's all about material life. If you follow his system, you get his association. It's like the Yamadut is serving Yamaraj. Anybody who serves Manu, his instructions, is getting the association of a great Vaishnava. That's the secret behind, you know, what's the secret trick behind the Varnashram system, is that it's a way, another way, and a broader way to give the association of Krishna's pure devotees. You serve indirectly. Shudra serves someone else, a Vaishya. The Vaishya is serving the king. The king is serving the Brahmins. The Brahmin is serving Krishna. So if you're linked up in that chain, you're indirectly serving Krishna also. Without knowledge, in ignorance, you're serving Krishna, but still you get the benefit. And then your conscience is purified, and you can become a Vaishnava too. And you will externally still act like whatever you are, Shudra or whatever, but inside you're changed, transformed. Okay, we've gone 8 minutes late, so stop here. We'll continue with this tomorrow. Thank you, all glorious Shiva Prabhupada, Srimad Bhagavatam.